Hey y'all, this is Stacey Pearsall, and you're listening to Everything, my podcast where I talk about, well, everything. Hey everybody, I'm Stacey, and this is...
Andy.
For part three.
And the last one, I hope.
Well, we don't know that yet, because we thought part two would be last, but there's so much
part
depth.
One should have been it.
There's so much to you, babe. It just takes a while.
Yes, it takes. I'm old.
Yeah, you are old.
I am.
Okay, it's pretty early on Tuesday morning. We usually do the podcast recordings Sunday or Monday.
Yes.
But we had quite a busy weekend.
Yes, we were wrapping up after your mom and Vic came to visit us.
Yeah, my mom and stepdad were here.
Yep.
They got to play with the horses and
donkeys
and the cars and the building project continues. Your garage is still under construction and my hand is still on the mend.
Let's talk about that real quick.
Okay.
When you see a crosswalk and you see a pedestrian with a service animal walking or coming up to the crosswalk, you should what? Stop. Even if you're in Georgia or South Carolina.
Ooh,
this happened yesterday.
You're angry about this.
Still,
okay.
Yes.
Well, let's back up even further. Because yesterday was the day I had my pins removed. And I go in there and I ask the doctor, what should I expect on the pain level scale? And he said, oh, it'll be nothing. So he grabs his needle nose pliers and begins to pull the metal rods.
Did he pull the needle nose right out of his craftsman workbench?
No, he put on some surgical gloves first and then used some alcohol
wipes.
Then went
to the craftsman.
No local anesthetic, no drugs, just it's not going to hurt that bad. Just a little pressure. And actually, when he first nipped on the end of my pin, it didn't hurt. It just felt rather strange. And the first couple tugs were just this sort of pressure feeling. But then when the pin started coming loose a little bit and it was passing through the fracture, oh my God, just thinking about it now makes me want to vomit because...
I don't have a bucket or a barf bag, so you're going to have to hold it.
Right. Well, apparently the surgeon who put the pins in place really put them in good, which is great. Thank you, Doc. But it made it a bear to get out.
Or your bone was healing so well. I didn't want it to leave.
Probably a little both. However, the doc had to begin to rotate back and forth. And those pins aren't bone straight, right? There's a bit of a curve to them. So with every rotation, it was moving my bone at the fracture point. And I almost died, figuratively speaking.
Right.
Anyway, I survived. Caught my breath. Got a new brace. Now I can move my fingers around. Woohoo! And as Charlie and I were exiting the hospital, we were approaching the
crosswalk
to the main parking area.
Where I was.
Where you were. And I was looking across the street, saw you. And Charlie, you know, we paused and saw that there was a car coming, but we had the right of way. The car was supposed to stop. There's ample signage there at the VA. And I look up, and the car breezes right in front of us.
Right in front of you.
Right in front of us. Right. And I was so startled. And then after... the trauma of my hand and then almost getting hit by a car. And of course, no one hurts my Charlie.
Right. So you went and said something to this person.
I went and knocked on that veteran's window.
Well, we don't know if he was a veteran.
Well, he may not have been.
He could have been the provider.
True. And he, or he may have been a spouse or something
right.
else. Anyway, I knocked on the individual's window and I said, sir, you didn't stop for the crosswalk while I was in the crosswalk. And... that was very dangerous, and you nearly hit myself and my service animal.
Right.
And he laughed at me.
That's so wrong.
So wrong. Anyway, the moral of the story, please stop at crosswalks.
Yes.
And don't laugh at somebody.
No.
When they're scared.
No. He was wrong.
Back to you, babe.
Awesome.
I had a lot of feedback. Thank you, everybody, for visiting everythingstacey.com and sharing with me your thoughts on the last couple podcasts about my significant other.
What was the feedback? Less Andy, more Stacey?
Oh,
cowbell?
No. They were very appreciative of learning more about you. And Miss Coppice, our friend in Louisiana, said that by better understanding you, she could better understand
your craziness.
Absolutely. Or why I am crazy, because you make me so.
Yes, I am a lot to deal with.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. The feeling's mutual, though, I suppose.
I concur.
Okay. All right. Well, we left off last week. We were talking about you being in Korea and then getting an assignment to Charleston, South Carolina, to the 1st Combat Camera Squadron, getting here, thinking you were going to go to Afghanistan or Iraq or somewhere like that, and they sent you back to Bosnia for the third time?
Third and last time.
So that's where we left off. Okay. We were about to dive into a whole nother shoebox of information, but we had hit time. So let's pick up where we left off. I had come back from my first deployment to Iraq and found out about this really cool job with the Secretary of Defense. It was the
Yes, but before that, I went to the NCO Academy. They would, so it wasn't bad enough I had to go to Bosnia during the war. They said, "Oh, since you made Tech Sergeant E6," which I understood, it's part of the deal. But I could have gone after a deployment, so I had to go for 6 weeks to the academy.
Mm-hmm. Can we explain to non-military members what what higher education looks like, or excuse me, leadership education? Higher is kind of a misnomer.
Right, it's a 6 week course where you're in class with other NCOs that made the rank, and you're instructed on leadership.
Right. Now there are many phases of this leadership education for service members. First, if you're an airman and you're about to make NCO,
right,
you have to go to a mid-tier NCO
Airman Leadership School,
right. Which I did, and I got Levito, by the way.
Good for you.
Isn't that pretty awesome?
That's so awesome. Big clap on the back.
Woo-hoo! There you go. Pat.
Pat, yes.
Then if you are a tech sergeant and you make master sergeant, then you have to go to...
Well, then you have to go to the senior to
senior NCO academy
in order to make to put on E8, E9. But those, actually, in my opinion, those schools should be sooner, because you need that NCO academy when you're a staff to really be an effective leader.
Right.
You need it sooner than later.
Well, some people will never be good leaders, though.
Right. It's in your blood.
Some people just do not get...
Some people lead. Leadership. Some people manage. Some people just don't give a shit.
True. All right.
Okay.
So they make you go to the NCO Academy, and all you want to do is deploy.
I want to go to combat and take pictures.
Sure. And you come back, and they say, you're not going. Hold on. But you cut me off, because I was talking about this new position.
Right. They created something new.
That was for the Secretary of Defense, then the Honorable Mr. Donald Rumsfeld.
Right.
And I wanted to apply for it.
Which you did.
Which I did. And several other people as well.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely more qualified and better than me, including
myself.
You. Yeah. Now, you happened to have a shoe in because you knew somebody up in the upper echelons, I think.
No, I didn't actually.
And you're like, hey, don't pick anybody else. You got to pick me.
No, so at the time, Colonel Douglas, Clifton Douglas.
Best commander ever.
Right. Well, he's old school combat camera. He grew up as a lieutenant in ComCam. But he was the one that submitted our packages to Colonel Hahn and Holland Wheeler up at the SecDef's job.
You love throwing out names. People will have no idea who they are.
Google. Anyway, so I think the combat camera, or I don't know if the whole Air Force got the message, but we submitted how many people was from ComCam. And then we had to do phone interviews in Colonel Douglas's office. And I was the first one up. I sat in his office by myself on the phone with the staff, and they said, when can you be here?
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, so I got the job. So I went up there and followed around Rumsfeld for 6 months.
Which I find strange, because I didn't even get a call back. I didn't get a telephone interview. They were like,
they just knew.
They just knew. It had to be the Andy Dunaway.
It was my charm over the phone.
I don't think so.
No.
Okay, what was your first day like on the job then? In Washington, D.C., in the Beltway, you're a hardcore combat guy. Now you're rubbing elbows with suits and
right,
briefcases.
Right, so I had to wear blues. You know, you wear your blue, not your service dress, but, you know, your blues. And I had to take the metro to get in there. And it was, you know, it's a secure place. But
hold on. Can we pause there for a second? You do not do well with congestion, loud noises, lots of people, everything D.C. has to offer. And And then you had to take the metro, which could be one of the most confusing things to figure out initially.
Well, I conquered it in Korea. I mean, I had the help of Jerry Morrison and some friends, but I was like, if I can do Korea, I can do the Beltway.
So you figured it out.
I figured it out, yes. And
how
it was
many,
like,
how many times did you get lost on the on
oh,
the
it was just, it was an easy, I think I was the second stop from Crystal City. It was really legit.
So you were living in a dumpster outside the Pentagon, essentially.
No, it was pretty. It was nice. It worked out very well. But I could get into work. I was always early, and it was. I didn't get to meet Rumsfeld until our first trip, because you know at that time he was handing out these things called the snowflakes, and
what is that?
It was like a memo. He would write a memo, and it would say, you know, it was always derogatory, like this person sucks or this is wrong, but everyone took it like you're going to get fired.
Ooh.
So they were very intimidated by Rumsfeld. So instead of getting a meeting with him to say, this is your new guy, I just happened to meet him on a plane. And they're like, oh, this is your photographer. Hmm. The guy with all the camera gear.
Yeah, duh.
Right.
Okay, hold on. Can we pause for a second? Because we just talked about the NCO Academy and leadership. How effective were these snowflakes? Because to me, that seems counterintuitive.
They were just his way of passing down messages about what he liked and didn't like on certain topics.
Hmm. Okay.
Yeah. But he was very busy. He had meetings every week. He traveled extensively. When he got back, he had more meetings, and he just wanted certain coverage of what he was doing and seeing throughout the world.
He was, by the time he became Secretary of Defense under George W. Bush, he was pretty old, right?
Right. That was his second time at it. So he did it before with the, I believe, the Ford administration. Then it went into the private sector and came back for Bush. And, you know, he wasn't hired on because we were going to war. He was hired on because he was just trying to retool the Pentagon and the civil service, how that system worked. And then we went to war and he was like, okay, let's do this.
Looking at your body of work from that period of time with Secretary Rumsfeld, It looked like you never really had a moment's peace, because every picture I saw of him, he was standing up or he was walking somewhere or he was lecturing somewhere or doing an interview. What was that like?
Yeah, the man was a machine. His office, he did not have a chair behind his desk. He had a stand-up desk.
Yeah.
So he never sat unless it was to get a quick bite to eat. And even that was, you know, crackers and, you know, tuna fish or whatever his snack was. He was always busy, always talking to his microphone, had a little tape recorder, and I think someone would dictate that stuff back and fix it, but constantly moving. And he, everywhere we went, he shook everyone's hand, signed stuff for everybody. We went in Afghanistan and Iraq twice. We went to the PACAF. Yeah, he was all about work.
Speaking of Iraq, I remember it was around Thanksgiving 2003. I had just come off a very, very, very long mission with the Black Hawk crew, and we landed at the Baghdad International Airport, and we were trying to taxi over because we were about to miss Thanksgiving dinner.
Mm-hmm.
When they shut the entire airport down because of a diplomat coming in.
Your Secretary of Defense.
They didn't tell us that.
Right.
All they said was, airspace is closed. So we're landing, and we're idling off to the side because of Secret Service and this whole nine, and we were just getting really super frustrated and finally got the clearance to taxi up, and we were getting off, and then I saw you moseying on down the staircase of Air Force 2?
No, it was, I think there we had the C-17. We would transition from base to base in the 17 in theater, and then once we got back out of the theater, we would get back into like the Air Force 2.
Oh, I thought it was Air Force 2. Maybe my memory.
It might have been, but I don't remember. I think it was their 17s. They were always 17s back in that time.
The short of it was,
I ruined your Thanksgiving.
You totally ruined my Thanksgiving.
You're welcome.
Thanks, appreciate it. And then what was great is that you got to go right back on the airplane and go back to a nice hotel somewhere, probably in Europe, probably with a hot meal. And then I had to go back to the grind in my tent.
I would have gladly traded with you.
Uh-huh. Right.
Right.
Well, anyway, at that point, you and I didn't know each other all that well. I despised you. I thought you were kind of a jerk. And then you took my Secretary of Defense job, and then you locked out my Thanksgiving meal.
Yes, I did that single-handedly.
You did. Yes. Damn you. But anyway, you took off. I went back to work. And then I really don't remember seeing you again for quite a long time. So what happened? How long were you with the Secretary of Defense?
So I was with them for 6 months.
That's a long time for a...
It was, but you know, it took a while to get into the groove of what it was expected. You know, everything that I photographed had to be reviewed from him and his staff to make sure the message was right. And then it came up to the 6 months. They had offered I could have stayed, like I could have made that a permanent duty change. And I was like, no, I want to go to Iraq. I want to go see combat. And they're like, what do you mean you
want? And they're like, you want to do that?
Right. And I said, plus this covering Rumsfeld is a great experience. I thought others should get to take the opportunity to see this and document it. So we sent out another message for the second round of applications.
Great. I don't know where I was. Maybe I was in school at that point. Maybe I was at Syracuse. I don't know.
No, this was at the end of, 2003 or four, something like that.
I was still in Iraq.
Right. So we pick someone, we get the amazing Jerry Morrison to relieve me. And I will say, not to diminish how I was introduced to Rumsfeld, but when Jerry came in, I made an appointment. I got to take Jerry into Rumsfeld's office. Not only did he meet Rumsfeld, he met Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice.
Wow.
So he got the proper introduction. So Rumsfeld knew, like, Jerry's the dude. Yeah. If I need photos, he's my guy.
Well, let's go back to that leadership course,
because
a true leader will set their subordinates up for success, or peers, rather, in this case, and that you will punish in private and praise in public. And I think you do a really great job of that.
Sometimes I get upset.
I think when you do, though, you manage your... You manage your anger until you're in a private place where you can actually, have a diplomatic conversation with somebody about what is not right. But anyway, by learning your experience and not having a really great introduction into
I try to make
system,
it right.
You knew that that was a problem. You identified it and you found a really great solution. So great.
Right.
Thank you for that. I wish it was me.
But
Jerry is a really great photographer. So, you know. You can't win them all. Okay, so you get done with Secretary Rumsfeld's job, and then?
I think I'm going to Iraq or Afghanistan, and no, I'm on the beeper.
What is that, a beeper?
So combat camera at the time, we had a global responsibility for 30 days we'd carry the beeper. We had a small team, a contingency team, that we could react within 30 minutes to be anywhere on the planet. So myself and I forget the team, we were on it in Haiti. Erupted. So myself, my video partner, Luella, jump on a C-17 with all of our junk, and we said, all right, we're getting off here. And the pilots were like, what do you mean you're getting off here? I'm like, yeah, we're staying. And they're like, you're crazy, but whatever. So we stayed there for, I think, a month.
You were with the Marines, right?
We documented the Marines. We photographed a lot of our security forces that handled the airport security.
So what was going on in Haiti at that time that you said things erupted? What exactly was?
I think the president, I don't know if he was outed or he left, but there was a lot of turmoil, and we were just there to make sure they didn't get crazy. So we did a lot of operations with the Marines, just foot walking the streets, doing a lot of stuff at night, and that was a month. And then we got back home, and finally in 2005, I had my opportunity to go to Iraq.
You finally get your orders to Iraq. Hooray!
Yes, I'm very excited. Get all my gear, get all my training.
Now, did you spend any time looking at the imagery that was coming out of Iraq already?
Oh, yeah, every day. When I was at the Pentagon with Rumsfeld, not only did I photograph him, but I got to see everything. Everything the Army was doing, the Marine Corps, the Navy, the Air Force.
Was there any standouts that you thought,
really
great work?
Everyone was doing great work. I mean... In extreme conditions, yes, everyone was doing great work.
Did you have it in your mind, the things you wanted to concentrate on? Did you see holes in the photography or imagery that was coming out?
No, I just wanted to go out and I just wanted to, if you're going to be a combat photographer, you should be able to go to combat and live that part of it.
Right. What year was that you went the first time?
Right. So 2005 was my first boots. I don't consider when I went there with Rumsfeld to be combat. So I mm-hmm. considered my first deployment with our team in 2005.
Okay.
Yep.
Now, you land in Iraq. Are you immediately assigned to an Army unit, or are you with Air Force? How did that work?
Right. We were all assigned to Army units because they just couldn't keep up with the rotation cycles. And there was, you know, I'm not sure how big their units are, but they were running out of the active duty and the Guard and Reserve. So
they being the Army.
The Army. So the Army reached out to the DOD. DOD reached out to us in the Navy, and we were backfilling their slots. Mm-hmm. So myself and Harry Fisher were going to go out to...
Harry Fisher being a videographer.
My videographer partner. To Rawa. That was... west, northwest, way out, moon dust country. It was bizarre, but some of my luggage was misplaced, so I had to get new uniforms. And in that time period,
you said luggage like a civilian,
right? Well, my
do you mean like a rucksack?
My rucksack, and yeah, my ruck was misplaced.
Oh,
so
God.
I had minimal.
Excuse me, have you seen my luggage? Here's my bag tag.
My Tumi is missing.
It doesn't work like that.
My rollaway is gone.
Excuse me, I'm Air Force, and I have my matched luggage here.
So it finally showed up months later. I'm already forward deployed somewhere, but the captain got me new gear. We got all my stuff sewed up. Harry and I modified our stuff to be more practical. But anyways, I knew we were doing special missions of prisoners that we were detaining, and so I wanted to stay there long enough to do that. And so I got to photograph... and I couldn't talk about it for 10 years, but I got to photograph Saddam. Mm-hmm. Every time he went into a trial room, they had to document his movements.
That's interesting. Can you describe to me, I mean, the whole reason we were in Iraq was because of Saddam. Can you describe to me what it was like to be in the same
room? It was intense. And it was him, his counsel, the judge, and then to the right of me was, I don't know, 12 chairs of... and we all had civilian clothes on. No one was in uniform, but they looked like they were with agencies.
Mm-hmm.
And he walked in with his Quran, sat down, and you just document everything. And I had a video partner, which I can't say his name because he's still in. But yeah, so I got to photograph him, and I had a camera battery. This is my story I always tell people: never buy a third party battery, because at this time, we were using D1s or D2s, and I rotated my camera to go vertical, and the battery chamber was pointed down, and the door didn't close all the way, so the battery fell to the ground and made this loud bang, and Saddam like looks right at me. I was like, oh my God, he's going to burn me up or something. So I immediately pick it up, put it back in the camera, and go to work, and I call back to the ComCam unit. I said, let's never buy these batteries again. And so I never, ever recommend third-party batteries.
Were you, like, gaff-taping your batteries to your cameras after
that? I was upset.
How scary.
Yes. Well, to have everyone look at you, like, what's going on here?
Well, that's what I mean. Right. I don't mean scary as in, oh, my battery fell out. That was scary. No, I mean, like, all eyes being on you, especially at such a critical point in history. Mm-hmm. Like, you're the buffoon whose battery fell out of your camera. You idiot.
Yes.
Well, that's what I would be thinking to myself.
Yep.
Was it like that?
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't hide anywhere. There wasn't anywhere. Couldn't crawl behind anything and
hide.
Oh,
my gosh. But yeah. you had the attention of one of the most notorious dictators for a split second when your battery clanked on the ground.
Yes, that's awesome. No.
I think I would have tinkled my pants a little.
Yeah. So we finished that, and then I think maybe a few more days, and we caught a Chinook all the way out to Rawa, and it was at night. Chaff and flare going because of gunfire. It was like, here's your welcome and here's what you wanted.
Was it what you expected? You had waited all these years to go, and you were there.
It was very learning. I learned real fast on that first trip what I don't need. I mean, we had just all of our junk, and I was like, I don't need all this junk.
I need my markers and my post-its and my notepads.
No, I mean, we had, you know, we're air crew as well, so I thought I needed all my air crew crap. Well, that was not ever needed.
Not with the Army tasking.
No, so I was like, send this stuff back, and I minimized. Like, if I couldn't carry it in one ruck,
mm-hmm.
I didn't need it. So
now I found that carrying a long rifle got in the way of me doing my job, mm-hmm. and I decided early on that I was not going to be doing that. Instead, I would just carry my
right, the 9mm
pistol. So what was your... go-to gun?
At the beginning, I carried both just because I didn't know what these guys were expecting of us. Mm-hmm. You know, we had to do a right seat, left seat scenario with the guys that we were replacing. You just didn't go in there and they took you. You had to prove yourself. So we had to go on missions with my Army combat camera counterparts to prove that I knew what I was doing. Mm-hmm. So we did a few whatever missions, and he's like, okay, you're good. Then he flew out, and then we did early ODOC 30, climb over cinder block walls with all your crap, and then they would get these, you know, like a Copenhagen can, mm-hmm. a dip can, mm-hmm. and they would haul that out. You know, they'd take everything out, and they'd put deck cord in there, and they'd put that against a door, and that's what they used to knock down a door. I mean, it was all tactics, like. So that was, and these guys were 18 years old, striker brigades out of Alaska, and they would just run circles around me.
I think I was
37 or 30. I was in my 30s, late 30s, and I thought I was in pretty good shape, but these guys could just.
Well, I mean, think about how much weight you're carrying in body armor, and then your photo gear on top of that, and then your tactical gear in addition to all of that. And you've got old man knees.
I got old man, right. And so it was definitely experience in the striker, knocking down doors, photographing everything, trying to catch your breath, and because these guys aren't taking a break. And then coming back to the FOB and trying to download all your images and then upload them mm-hmm. through the MRSAT systems. Yeah.
On that deployment, you got hit by an anti-tank mine?
Right, within my first month, right? Welcome, you get what you want. We were coming back from the Syrian border. We were out there for a week doing missions, and we were coming back late. And you're in a vehicle, so I think I had my armor off, listening to my Walkman, my beginner iPod, you know, the thick, mm-hmm. the stick,
yeah,
right? And all of a sudden, we hear gunfire, and the chatter's like, okay, we're ready to dismount. We're going to go get this person.
And wait, hold on. You didn't have your body armor on?
We're inside. Well, we geared up, right? So we're gearing up. We're getting everything on. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, we run over something, and it just exploded. And it was the loudest sound I've ever heard. The vehicle goes up and over. It doesn't rotate or anything. It doesn't flip over, but it pushes us up in the air, the vehicle up. And this is a heavy vehicle, a striker, you know, eight-wheeled. $2 million tactical vehicle, and loud sound, ears piercing. And when I come to, you know, I start touching my hands and my feet. And I'm like, okay, I have all my body parts. And then I start hearing the front gunner asking for help. And then the we call him the truck commander. He was an E6, a sergeant, comes down out of the rear air guard. And he had blood coming out of the back of his neck from his head around mm-hmm. the helmet area. And I was like, because I think there was a safety light on. Somehow I could see something. And he pulls out this piece of shrapnel. I said, dude, you need to go see a medic, right? I mean, from the bomb or whatever went off, IED or landmine. And he looked at me and he goes, we're strikers. We don't see medics. So that kind of set the tone for all my deployments. Like, if you're not missing a limb, or body, you know, like you're bleeding out, mm-hmm. you don't go see docs. Mm-hmm. So I was like, okay, that's my first class. So I'm the first one to dismount. We get everyone, you know, that we get the driver out of his hole. We get the gunner out. We're all there. I dismount. It's completely dark. There's nothing out there. And then within 5 minutes, the rest of our striker team comes in behind us to help us police the area. And we had to, you know, basically take everything out of the striker that we needed. And they shoved us into another fully loaded striker. So like sardines, we're just stuck in here. We're finally going back. And we never did chase the bad guy because obviously our striker is gone. And the typical Army guys were like, dude, we can get some spare parts off your striker now. And the striker guy was like, that was my fucking truck that just got hit, right? Like, some respect here. So we all get in this other striker. We're driving back to camp, or the FOB, or whatever you want to call it, and our fuel vehicle rolled over. So who do they send out to guard the fuel vehicle? The guys that just got blown up, right? Mm-hmm. Not the other guys are arrested or not whatever. No, the dudes that just got literally blown up and don't have their stuff together, mm-hmm. right? So we had to stand there for I don't know how many hours to wait for a wrecker to come pull this thing out. So we get back, and it was daylight out when we get back, and our striker's over there just demolished. It must have breached. It didn't breach the hull of it, but you could see a mushroom impact. It mm-hmm. was devastating. And I think we were there for maybe another week or two. Fisher wasn't with me in my striker. He was in a different vehicle because he didn't have enough room for all of us in one. Mm-hmm. So he didn't get impacted. But we went from there. Then I think we went to Fob McHenry, which was another paradise place. You know, this is, but that's Iraq. And we stayed there majority of our time until our deployment was over.
That morning, after you got hit by a bomb, did you have any second thoughts about
none?
All no. your desire?
No, I mean, I was just like, let's go clean up and let's go back at it. And I don't know, I'm not sure why we got pulled out to go to a different place. I don't know if it was, I think that base eventually got closed because they had Marines out there as well mm-hmm. at a different FOB from us. And I think what was going on is the map, the Marines were taking over their geographical area, the West, mm-hmm. and the Army was more concentrating in Baghdad and other areas. Mm-hmm. So I think they pulled us back for that.
Okay. Did you have any thoughts about that could have been the end of it? And did that begin to stay in the forefront of your mind, or did you just shove it on down to later?
No, I just went to work. I mean, it was, you know, every FOB you go into, they have a cop, or I forget what they call their headquarters places. You know,
command operations.
Right, mm-hmm. the cop or whatever. So we'd go in there, and they had the wall of heroes that had recently passed. They always had a bio and what happened. Mm-hmm. Like IED hit vehicle burned, everyone perished inside of it, whatever the scenarios were. So my buddy was reading this stuff, and he was like, I'm never going to sit on the rear passenger driver or passenger side because that's where the fuel tank is. Mm-hmm. And I looked at him and I said, dude, you can't think that way because it's going to happen. It's going to happen. No matter what side of the vehicle you're in, mm-hmm. you're going to get hit. And so he would walk up and down, you know, the vehicles before a mission looking for a seat that was open that wasn't on the gas tank. And I was it's like, whatever.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, you just do it. I mean, it's a real thing because every time you go out on a mission, you do a live fire of your weapons, lock and loaded. And the 50 cal would always do, you know, its thing. And it definitely lets you know, like, this is not an exercise. This is real.
Real.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of real, we are really going to have to carry this over.
Are we out of time already?
Yes.
I'm so sorry.
We're over time. Okay, everybody. Now, if you are on a cliffhanger like I am, because I'm hearing some of this stuff for the first time myself, join me and Andy next week.
I'm sorry, folks.
No, I'm excited to know all of this. But anyway, we are going to learn everything about Andy, however many episodes it takes. So I hope you have an incredible week. And this is everything. I'm Stacy.
I'm Andy.
We'll talk to you next week, and be well.
Be well.